This is the Automotive Repair Podcast Network.
Hey everybody, Carm Capriotto, Remarkable Results Radio, and another Town Hall Academy. Thank you so much for being here over the 10 years that I've been doing this. We are so darn excited to announce our new app. Yes, it's your own listening app just for everyone in the Automotive Repair Podcast Network, of which we've recently rebranded from the Aftermarket Radio Network to the Automotive Repair Network. You can see us at the Automotive Repair Podcast Network.com. Go there. All kinds of stuff pointing you in the direction in order for you to get this app and download it. I've got a great topic today, tactics to stay out of debt. Got a great panel. Before we move, thanks so much to Napa Trax. You know, local reps are there to optimize your SMS and you get daily training for your entire team. Today's class is also a great sponsor, a quick way to spot knowledge gaps and grow stronger teams. Kukui, thanks to Kukui, get industry-leading customer support with Kukui and pit crew loyalty. Turn visits into lasting vehicle revenue. Hey, did you know that Napa Trax has on-site training plus 6 days a week support? It all starts when a local representative meets with you to learn about your business and how you run it. After all, it's your shop, so it's your choice. Let us prove to you that Trax is the single best shop management system in the business. Find Napa Trax on the web at NAPATRACS.com. Hey, how well does your team know their stuff? Test their automotive skills with the Today's Class Basic, Advanced, or Service Advisor quizzes. It's a quick, effective way to spot gaps and grow stronger teams. Take the quizzes now at todaysclass.com/TC quiz. Shop owners, stop juggling multiple marketing tools. Kukui's integrated platform, they deliver 4 times better website conversions, automated follow-up, and real-time ROI tracking. Get industry-leading customer support with Kukui. That's KUKUI.com. You're probably tired of chasing new customers who never return. We understand. Pit crew loyalty ends the one-and-done cycle, turning first visits into lasting, reliable revenue. On the web at pitcrewloyalty.com. Hey, welcome back. Let me introduce my great panel to talk about tactics to stay out of debt. Saju Thomas, Five Shops, Denver, Colorado. Hello, Saju.
Good morning. Now we're actually at 6.
I'm sorry. I apologize. I knew that. And I was at his place, was it last week?
Last Tuesday, that's right.
Last Tuesday, I was in Denver and gave my Rise of the Specialist speech to the Denver Napa BDG. And on the way there, Dustin Old just said, listen, we're going to go to this place. Saju Thomas, this is one of his oldest buildings. It is so cool. You got to go in there and see it. And I said, no. And so we met for the first time. And of course, we knew that a week later, he's going to be on this podcast. Thank you so much. Great operation. I met a lot of his leadership team. So
thanks for having me, Carm.
Good to meet you, man. Hunt Demarest is here. CPA, Parr Mellison Associates in Business by the Numbers podcast on the Automotive Repair Podcast Network. Hello, Hunt.
Hey, Carm.
When I listen to your stuff, I always hear the ringings of debt. Pay attention, you always say. Pay attention to your debt.
I thought you were going to say you hear ums and a lot of pauses and stuff like that. So I'll appreciate that.
Yeah, well, we do, but our job is to get rid of them so that the listener has a really quality experience.
Exactly.
Dustin Brown is here. I'm probably going to say the number of locations wrong. How many are you up to now?
We're at 5. Yeah.
So a couple of years ago, I think there were 3. Now there's 5 in New Mexico.
Yep. Beautiful state of New Mexico. Starting to cool off a little bit, but it's all right. We're enjoying the weather.
Good for you. Okay. We've got the specialist in automotive shop, CPA, finance, smart guy, and 2 multi-shop operators that have probably dabbled in debt in their lifetime. And so we want to talk about maybe scaling trends and what to do about money, maybe cash reserves, budgeting, good debt versus dumb debt. I think Hunt wants to talk about that and investment in equipment. But first of all, I want to talk about one thing, Dustin, and you, this is a talking point you sent to me. And I have to tell you, I've always believed in this. Cash is king.
Cash is always king. You can't make anything happen. Hold on to that cash, save it. If you can even move it, you don't have to necessarily keep it in the company. I think Hunt will have some things to say about the risk associated with stashing a whole lot of cash within your entity itself. But yeah, cash is king. If you can utilize cash to expand and grow, use it as a tool that's going to be much more beneficial in the long run. And, you know, it's going to give you better terms as well when it comes to any debt that you're going to want to acquire.
You know, when we're talking about cash, gentlemen, do we need to have, or maybe you can, how many months of expenses? I mean, let's go back to COVID and just think about, boom, that happened to us. How many months of cash reserves do you need just to sustain the business if something happens?
So general rule of thumb is 3 to 6 months of operating expenses. Really, I will tell people of, hey, if you want a rule of thumb, then fine, but it's just that. In actuality, it's a lot more complicated because it depends on your specific business. If you have a high volume shop with lower ARO, don't have a whole lot of carryover from month to month, and are extremely consistent on your sales, you can probably operate with much lower reserves because you don't really have a whole lot of cash flow crunches. And compare that to some of my fleet guys or maybe a restoration shop. You're going to have much larger reserves because of some of those inflows and outflows can swing massively from week to week.
Any thoughts on that, Saju?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Hunt brings up that point of every shop is going to be quite different. In my organization, we have those high value volume shops that have, you know, tremendous car count, strong ARO, strong customer demand. And for shops like that, you can be a little more, I'd say, liberal or have less cash stashed because there's a strength and foundation to that business. At the same time, in our organization, we have a few shops that are a little bit newer. There's more marketing spend as a percentage of total revenue. It has a higher growth trajectory. And if something were to go sideways, whether it be COVID, whether it be something geopolitical, those are the stores that I feel are going to be less resilient. And like when COVID happened, I took a lot of pride in not laying off employees, making sure our team was taken care of. And I think that's part of the ownership responsibility to have financial discipline for the sake of all stakeholders, employees, vendors, customers, et cetera.
Hunt, is there any kind of magical formula? You take on a new client and you look at their debt load. Do you look at one of these teeter-totter things by saying, one of the things that we have to work on is getting you a semi out of debt?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you could argue two different aspects of this, right? Because, you know, like what Dustin and Shiju were both saying is cash is king here. And so the businesses that did well during COVID and were able to keep their customers, sleep at night, not make impulse decisions based on cash flow were not my most profitable businesses. It's the ones that had the most cash. Because some of these extreme events that happen, profit and cash flow can stop instantly. But if you have the proper reserves, you can still stay the course and make the right long-term decisions. Whereas if you don't have the cash and you don't have access to any cash on it, you're making decisions specifically based on cash flow. And so, yeah, we get some clients where we come on board and they say, hey, your business is good. The actual business itself is making money and we got to get a plan to tackle this debt and get out of debt. But there's also some businesses that are also stifled by their lack of cash. And there's ways to bootstrap it. You could say, hey, you know what? We don't want to get into debt. We're going to bootstrap this and we're going to try to get out of this on our own. But there's also some people where it's like, maybe we need to get some smart debt to be able to invest in ourselves and actually dig ourselves out of a hole even faster than being debt-free.
I would suggest, and Hunt, you would know better than me, the majority of debt held by auto shop owners in this country, I bet, is related to real estate, which is probably a very different type of debt than when we think about the business debt. And it has a different risk profile, particularly because most of that real estate debt is really getting paid by the businesses that need to pay a normal market rent for that space. And therefore, your real estate debt is actually far more healthy and less risky than, say, the business debt that some people might acquire, whether that be for equipment or potentially acquisition.
Absolutely right. Yeah. If you want to use two examples of like the most common things that I see, and we want to talk about good debt for one and bad debt on the other. If you have real estate, that is good debt, right? It's collateralized. There's an underlying asset behind it. We have a liability, but the asset should be worth significantly more and it'll continue to grow. But if you look at good debt and you're saying you're going to have to be in a piece of real estate or a location no matter what, your rent is $6,500. If you buy that, it's going to be a monthly mortgage payment of $4,500. I mean, that makes sense from cash flow, investing, future, everything on this. If you want to look at what the worst debt is on the average shop's books, it's a high interest credit card advance. There's zero collateral on it. There is no underlying asset. It is strictly a liability. And even worse on that, compared to maybe a 25-year amortization or 30-year amortization on real estate, some of these high interest aggressive credit card advances are 3-month repayment or 6-month repayment, which is really what's killing shops.
Wow. We could probably go on and do a whole entire show on that, Hunt. I think you may have in the past on your show.
I think we have. Yep.
I hear the word cash flow, and I'm going to add a third word to that, cash flow statement. Hunt, do all of your clients get a cash flow statement every month?
So yes and no. So the way that we issue all of our balance sheets is in comparative format. And so what we're looking at is we're looking at current year numbers and we're relating it to the end of the previous year or previous fiscal year. And then the third column is going to be the change. So if we give out the cash flow statement out of QuickBooks, QuickBooks actually does a really bad cash flow statement. They give people way too much information. But one of the primary objectives when I'm talking to my clients is we're going to say your profit and loss made $150,000. You know, my clients look at their bank account and they say, my bank account is no different. That comparative balance sheet allows us to show the cash flow. There's the change in inventory. There's your change in accounts receivable. Here's you paying down debt. Because yeah, you're absolutely right, Carm. Everyone wants to know what their profit is, but what people are really feeling and really care about is their cash flow.
Hunt, you said I made all that money. Where is it?
Where is the money?
If you had a legit cash flow statement, but I love your idea. Why get another statement in the mix? Just look at the, you know, you want to know where your cash is? Well, it's over here in this debt category. And that's why there's none compared to what you had at the end of the last year. Even though you made a lot of money, you spent money or you moved it around in different places instead of the bank. You didn't go in there in the safe deposit box and count the hundreds.
I think a lot of shop owners, you know, they're not accountants, right? Some of them, I don't think, are even looking at P&Ls as regularly as they really need to be. And they look at that P&L and they say, for example, I even made 150 grand. Just a common, you know, not everybody realizes that if you're paying off a note, only the interest is going to be on the P&L. The principal comes off afterwards. So you make 100 grand, you have to pay taxes, then you have to pay your principal on all your loans. So, and then whatever's left after that is money you could put in your pocket. I'm going to be missing one, but those are the two big ones that are always on. You got to pay the tax and you got to pay the principal. Really being mindful of what that looks like to manage your P&L to know, okay, I need to net profit X amount of dollars just to cover the cash needed to pay these loans is important to know what that number is. And that helps you take a decision on if you're going to take on more debt or not. Do I take out a loan to replace that alignment rack at $30,000 or do I hold it off because I don't have the cash flow after the net profit to pay that note on top of whatever responsibilities I might already have. So some people just don't really put those two together.
You make a really good point too, Dustin, here, because one of the things that we notice a lot is people think that they're healthier when we think they're unhealthier and vice versa. So a great example of this is if you have someone that goes out and gets a high interest loan deposited into a bank account, they're going to think that they're doing pretty well because they look at that operating account and they say, man, I got $100,000 in here. And then we look at this 6 months later on it and they're almost out of money and they say, man, what the heck is going on with the business? And we look at the underlying profitability and we say, actually, Dustin, you've never been more profitable. Your business has turned around and we're actually making profit. But since that loan that you got was a 6-month repayment, you're not seeing any of that. You're making profit and all that profit is going back to paying principal off. I mean, at the smallest baseline, what a bank is looking for is 1.25 coverage. So if you make $125,000, $25,000 of that's going to go to taxes, leaves you with $100,000 to pay your mortgage payment. So if you have $100,000 of debt service and you make $125,000 on your P&L, you should not expect to have any more money personally, any more money in the business. And that, like Dustin says, is a surprise to a lot of people.
That's a great comment, Hunt. And really, from a finance perspective, it's a question of cost of capital. At the end of the day, the business generates some level of cash flow. From that cash flow, there should be investments in capital expenditures, and it might be that lift that's $30,000 or $40,000. Now, in 5 different situations, Hunt might be advising his clients very different things and what to do. On one hand, you could have a different interest rate environment. If you can go buy that alignment rack and get it financed at 2 or 3% over the next few years, then that's a great way to utilize leverage. That's healthy debt. at a low interest rate. In another environment over the last couple of years, it's very high interest. So if you have a 7, 8, 9% interest rate on that loan and you don't have great debt service coverage, you're putting your shop at risk when you think you're investing in improving your business with that alignment rack.
Let's face it, your shop management system is the single most important tool in your shop, period. NapaTrax was built from the ground up to make your business more profitable and efficient. We provide an extensive set of tools to increase and track profitability in real time. NapaTrax offers the industry's best post-sale support, hands down, and we train your people on site. Yep, on site. And we offer remote refresher training 10 times a week, and customer support is open 6 days a week. Give us a call, visit the website, or join our Facebook community today to learn more. We'll prove to you that Trax is the single best shop management system in the business. NapaTrax is always customized and tailored for you, whether you're a one-man shop or a large multi-bay or multi-location company. After all, it's your shop, so it's your choice. Visit us on the web at NapaTrax, that's NapaTrax.com. Transform your team with today's class, where automotive training is easy, quick, and fun. Just 5 minutes a day on our app can eliminate hours of looking up forgotten information later. It's perfect for technicians, advisors, and managers alike. Keep critical knowledge fresh and top of mind, ensuring your team operates at peak efficiency. Today's class is impactful, accessible from anywhere, and a bit of fun too, and we're not talking about after-hours pizza either. For training that gets results, turn to todaysclass.com. Shop owners, we know you are overwhelmed with a flood of missed calls, empty bays, and disconnected marketing tools. Kukui has spent over a decade building one integrated platform for auto repair shops, one login, one dashboard, and mobile-first websites that convert four times industry average. Smart, innovative CRM with automated follow-up, 24/7 online booking, and real-time ROI tracking. With 900-plus years of combined team experience, we fuel the growth of 2,200-plus shops and have influenced $3 billion in revenue. Stop working harder. Start working smarter. Get industry-leading customer support and book a demo with Kukui. That's KUKUI.com. You know, most shop owners feel trapped, spending on ads while half their first-time customers never come back. It's frustrating. It's exhausting. And it's not your fault. The industry average is 54% one and dones. We understand how discouraging that can be. Well, Pit Crew Loyalty changes the story. Our clients cut that rate by up to 38%, raising lifetime value by more than 50%. Loyalty members visit nearly three times more often, creating predictable revenue without extra ad spend. Pit Crew Loyalty, where customers stay and shops thrive. On the web at pitcrewloyalty.com. Here's what's burning in my mind, and I need to ask Saju and Dustin, would you pick up the phone? You're successful, you're smart, you've been around a while, you get this thing. But for the hell of it, would you pick up your phone and call your accountant and say, I think I want to do something like this. Maybe it's a capital improvement, or maybe it's an ADAS piece of equipment and you're going to spend 50 or 60 grand. Saju or Dustin, would you pick up the phone and call the accountant, or are you gutting this yourself?
I don't. You know, I actually used to use Hunt's group over there, and there are cases that I call Billy. But for the most part, you know, I like to keep a really good thumb on my pulse when it comes to the financials. We mentioned Dave Ramsey a little bit, but I'm going to be looking at my cash to pay for that. If I don't have anything down the line, such as another acquisition, right? Because we are constantly kind of stacking some cash because we are lining ourselves up for the next acquisition, for the next investment opportunities to be ready for that potentially. So if I'm in the market for an expensive piece of equipment, we're weighing that against timeliness of acquisitions and growth. And so you need a lot more cash to acquire than you need to buy equipment. So most equipment is generated on like a cash purchase for our company. And unless there's something more strategic on, you know, ADAS would be a more strategic play. Like, how are we going to enter the ADAS environment? How are we going to enter the ADAS competition level? How much ADAS work are we going to be doing in-house? And how are we going to go out and outsource it, right? That's a whole different strategy there on how do you getting into ADAS repairs. But yeah, we're going to utilize cash at all possible if we can. If not, we're also going to utilize our vendors. So vendor utilization is going to be like, and I'll buy a lift from, and I'll buy PCC equipment from Napa. And Napa says, okay, increase your revenue by X amount of dollars each month, and we'll pay that note off for you. So there's utilization for vendors to help avoid any debt. But even in that case, I'm going to buy the equipment cash up front and look for the rebate on the statement and not depend on the rebate to pay that payment, because I don't want to be continuing to add more payments to the balance sheet. I want to always have a very healthy looking balance sheet, very healthy looking P&L, especially when we're looking at acquisitions and growth. So lastly, they'll stop you right in your tracks. You can't buy this building because you're debt heavy. Now your goals of acquisition and growth, you're going to be halted.
Seems like Dustin and I have near identical playbooks. I need to drive down to Albuquerque so we can compare notes. So I have a very similar mentality. When I think about the debt that I would bring into my organization, that the healthy debt, as we mentioned before, is going to be real estate as it relates to acquisitions and growth. The second would be some of the business acquisition debt, particularly the best version is, you know, a promissory note from a seller. And then the third, which I would consider, is equipment. But in reality, you really shouldn't be making huge equipment purchases if your cash flow can't cover those purchases. And I think Dustin hit it nail on the head. We have amazing vendors in the automotive industry that will partner with you for earnbacks and credits. And we've used Worldpac, Napa, Factory Motor Parts, and it has been a great asset to use tried and true vendors because they'll help you on the financing side if needed. And at the same time, you're getting a lot of earn back on spend you would already do with best-in-class vendors. So again, I think equipment financing, there's a place for it, especially in a lot of industries. But we're in an industry where healthy shops should generate a solid amount of cash flow. And really, equipment financing should be, I think, within that cash flow that the shop generates. And obviously, that's different for brand new shops where you know there's, you know, X, Y investment because you're trying to get it off the ground, but certainly not a mature shop.
Yeah, completely different for like a greenfield or brownfield buildup, right? If you get to buy six lifts and everything new, which I agree 100%. Which is you there, yeah.
Well, if you look at the cost of capital or just like the cost of equipment in general for an auto repair shop, it should really pair in comparison to what the revenue is, right? You go out and you buy a fairly expensive rack for $10,000. It's there for 10 years. How many gross profit dollars did that lift create for you? Like Shiju said, and Dustin was agreeing to, if your business is run correctly, you should have plenty of cash to replace that a decade later. If a decade later, your business doesn't have enough cash to replace that lift, then I'd really be looking back at the underlying profitability or cash flow decisions that led you to that point.
You know, when I sit and I listen to some of the incredible panels we have here, and to think if the semi-marginal shop was listening to this, and they became not overwhelmed, but enveloped in this discussion of how this really intelligent discussion can help them move forward and make a lot of right moves. Hunt, you had told me paying down debt too quickly may not be the right thing to do.
Yeah, I think what I see the most common issue is like debt is like a mountain or a valley for most shops. Either things are all good or all bad. And so like the most common example that I see of someone coming out of a rough year, right? Credit cards kind of went up, line of credit kind of got maxed out on it. This is generally in smaller shops that have some volatility, right? Maybe you lost a key player, a key production member in the shop. So over the course of 12 months, they built up $60,000, $80,000 in debt, but then they've kind of righted the ship. Profitability looks good and they're trending in the right direction. So they try to undo all of their past sins as quickly as they can. I don't want to be in debt. I know I want to retire at some point. I'm going to pay down debt. And now where we are is we're sitting here in August, September, October, and they're like, great, I am debt free, but I'm now also cash free. The way that you stay out of debt is by having cash, and the way that you continue that is keeping your reserves. So if you pay down all your debt and you have zero reserves left, it only takes one bad week or one bad month to be right back where you started.
That's great. And, you know, I'll add when I bought my first shop, didn't have a lot of credibility as an auto shop operator. The interest rate was relatively high on an SBA 7A loan. And it was a 10-year maturity that I paid back in 2 to 3 years. And I did that because it was expensive debt. Fast forward a few years, I was able to get much lower rates when I was doing other 7A acquisition loans. I was able to get low rates when I did 504 SBA deals. And those interest rates were anywhere from the high twos to the low fours. So I tell you what, I didn't prepay any of those because those are really cheap, long-term fixed rate loans that meant I could use my cash for other investments, whether that be equipment financing, whether it be additional business acquisitions, and especially real estate opportunities that come with those businesses that tend to be quite expensive, but great wealth building strategies. So again, I think there's nothing wrong with managing your leverage and making sure you're paying down expensive debt. Good example would be things like promissory notes that might come in those acquisitions that sometimes, not always, might demand a higher interest rate. Well, pay those down and then, you know, work from your highest interest loans to your lowest interest loans if you're really trying to be cash rich, let's call it. The other thing that we haven't mentioned is keep in mind that interest is tax deductible on your P&Ls. So in the long run, it's actually a way to create more cash flow in your pocket and decrease your taxable income.
That cash flow is key again. Going back to like what both of you said, let's say you pay off a debt accelerated, you pay off a debt quickly. In that example you gave Hunt, at the end of the year, he still owes taxes on all that money that he doesn't have, right? Because all that money he put into paying off the debt was all taxable income. So now the tax bill comes and you go, oh my God, how am I going to pay this tax bill? I don't have any money. I use it all to pay off this debt.
I think you've been listening to my phone calls.
you need the cash. You need to hold on to it. And Chizu, you're absolutely right. We've got some loans, you know, that are low interest rates. And we've got some that are now in the 6.5. I think the last one I got was like 6.5 or something because we just bought our last building last April. So if I'm looking at getting rid of cash and putting it towards principal, you know, that's going to be strategic. I'm definitely going to put it towards the highest interest loan. And I'm going to be looking at, okay, I have $100K. I can put $100,000 towards this principal on this loan, never get it back, right? Once it's gone, right? On that situation. Or I can put $100K down on this other property or on this other acquisition and start generating a much quicker ROI on that $100K. Because real estate generates an ROI, of course, and builds wealth. But it's kind of slow. It takes some time. You got to live there. You know, you don't just, our fastest ROI is going to be putting that $100K towards another building, another store, right? Or if you're a single store operator, it would be injecting it into some marketing to increase car count, increase revenue, increase sales, right? Inject that money into building and growing the value of the company, growing the revenue will give you a much higher ROI much faster than dumping the cash into the principal of a loan, specifically if the loan's low rate. Now, if you're on a high interest credit card, you got to pay that thing off right away, of course.
Immediately.
Right? Anything of that. Line of credits, keep those things low. Any of those high rate stuff, like, yeah, don't mess around with that. But if you got some 20, 15, 20, 30 year fix, some of these SBAs are 30 year fix. You just, cash is a tool to use.
One of the things too, that like kind of exactly what you're talking about of how do we attack debt? Which one are we going for? Like, it's fairly simple. Get your emotions out of it. It's going to be the highest interest rate. What's the most expensive? But then kind of going back to what I said before and what you just said now, Dustin, if I have $100,000 in a bank account and I have $100,000 on the credit line, I'm paying off the credit line immediately. As long as I have assurances that I can get money back off of there. If I ever need this, I can always get this back. But why am I sitting here paying 12% interest when this is getting me 0% in my checking account? Same thing with high interest credit cards. Yeah, I can pay off that $30,000 balance. If things get tight, then I'm just going to run up that card and swipe it everywhere the following month. Stuff like paying down, you know, true debt, where it's either, you know, equipment debt or real estate, it's a one-way street. Yeah, in real estate, in a larger sense, if you aggressively pay that down, you can get the money back out. But what if you can't qualify for a refinance? What if interest rates go up? Stuff that I can always draw back on, revolving credit lines, I'm always going to be much more aggressive on. And then the last one on here is, I think that probably the most common question I got during COVID, a lot of people got a lot of government money. What do they want to do? It's what everyone is shooting for as soon as they buy a house is, you want to own that house. You don't want the bank to own it. So I had a lot of shops that are like, "Hun, I got 300 grand in my bank account. I'm going to go on. I'm going to pay off my mortgage. I am so excited." And I say, I wouldn't do it if it was me. Emotionally, if you need to do this, fine. But it's probably one of your dumbest financial moves, because right now, you could put that 300 grand into a money market account and get 4% like clockwork. Why am I going to spend 4% to save 3.2%? It just doesn't make any sense. But again, if you have the same perspective on it and your mortgage is 6%, then yeah, it makes no sense to squirrel all my money away at 4% when I'm paying 6%. But a lot of people look at this and say, well, hey, what is your opinion? Going back to what Dustin was saying, if I can't make that decision for my client, I can give them the education, I can give them the tools to understand this stuff themselves, but they're the ones that ultimately need to make the right decision for their shop, their overall perspective.
One thing I'll jump in, great conversation, Dustin and Hunt, on the point of revolving credit lines. Normally, most shop owners I've talked to are leveraging a credit card for those situations. However, if you have a reasonable banking relationship, oftentimes you can get a line of credit. And for that line of credit, it's not going to be your 3 and 4% type of interest rate, but it's also not going to be the 20% interest rate that you have on a credit card. So you open this line of credit, and I've had one for years in which I've used it a total of zero times. And I pay a small fee each year to have it. But if something happens and somehow we are in a cash crunch, I could use that line of credit, access cash at a 8-9% interest rate. Not great, but it's far better than rolling the dice on a credit card.
But those are usually prime plus or minus, aren't they?
They are. And depending on your credit and your banking relationship, that's where it's going to be better than a credit card, but certainly not better than a standard conventional bank product.
So banking relationships, Siju, are like king?
You know, you bring up a good point, Garm, that I think traditionally banking relationships have held tremendous value in business growth. I venture to say today, they're still important. It is really important to know your bankers, but increasingly, the power at the bank is in the credit department. It's the underwriters and the credit officers. So one needs to be extraordinarily wary of bankers with great intention that promise you the world. And then all of a sudden, the credit department and the underwriting department don't like what deal you're looking at, what expansion strategy you're trying to pursue. And I've had some challenging situations where the bankers told me X, and on the backside, the credit department couldn't back up what the banker said. So yes, banking relationships are important, but this is where getting to know other people at the bank is extraordinarily important, and understanding what kind of influence that banker has on the credit department.
I want to add to that great point is quality banking relationships I have found to be more difficult to make. The reason is there's just been so much M&A activity when it comes to banking in general. So I had banked with I have a good relationship with a banker here in town. They got bought out and I don't know who's in charge and this guy's no longer there. And then I find my new banker and then he's there for 6 months and then he goes somewhere else. It's made it a lot more difficult in this day and age to really kind of create those relationships with bankers. I located a local bank. They're the last locally owned bank in town, you know, and the CEO is my banker now, right? I got a cell phone number. We go have lunch together, lunch a couple of weeks ago. And regarding acquisitions and growth, he's like, let's turnkey this. Let's put together a package. When you make a deal, we got to move fast. I can move fast with you. It's more difficult now, I think, than ever to establish those relationships with these bankers. Because he wants to do business with us, I have a bunch of cash in his bank, you know, and it's just a different world. So it's a little more challenging to find these guys.
Dustin's point was great. In order for him to get deals done now, he needs to be friends with the CEO of a bank. That tells you something.
Hey, it's like knowing who the head chef at the local pizzeria is, right? He's going to make it extra special for you.
Or it's like, hey, you were working with the vice president of Wells Fargo. Unfortunately, there's 50,000 vice presidents at Wells Fargo, right?
I love the point about being local. Do you feel that you're paying slightly, you know, half or quarter point more on money?
I think it's about the same. He's just what it is, what it is.
I would say that it wouldn't even be a quarter point. And there was a local bank I was using for multiple years, and I knew their pricing was probably 100 to 150 basis points higher, but it was significantly easier to work with them. And there was greater transparency. Their deal execution was flawless. And at some point, always looking for pricing, i.e. the cheapest product or the cheapest debt. It's no different than, you know, auto shops. There's customers out there that just want the cheap service and the cheap oil change and the cheap repairs with the terrible parts. Well, that's not necessarily my target customer. And I think there's banks out there that invest in high levels of service, extraordinary execution, and really take care of their clients. But there's a price to pay for that. So I don't mind paying a little bit more in my debt to know it's in good hands.
Just like our customers, our key droppers, right? Just get it fixed, call me when it's done, right? So you get these relationships and you trust them and they're going to make it happen. And you might look back and say, yeah, I paid a little more, but it was seamless. It was easy, worth every penny.
Yeah. And like you said, of like sometimes having that banker that actually is willing to fight for you at loan committee is the difference between you actually getting that opportunity and you not getting that opportunity. So if you're looking at something being like, hey, this bank's going to be at 6%, this one's going to be at 7%. What you actually might find out is the bank that's cheaper takes 9 months to actually go to closing on this, and I'm missing every single opportunity. What I would say in 2025, you can kind of tell by all of our tone here, Carm, it's never been harder to get a lasting relationship with a banker. It's fine. It's easy to get a relationship for 1 year, but what everyone's looking is a banker to grow with them. They understand what we're doing. They understand where we come from. When I call him up and I get these opportunities, I don't have to sell it to him because he knows what we're doing here. Realistically, I have always preached you should probably have a big bank and probably have a local bank. The sad reality is for probably 60% of my clients, they have one option or two options, and it's all the big banks. The consolidators, the local regional credit unions are just kind of being gobbled up, which I think it is even more important to understand this stuff and let your financials speak for yourselves. Because for most shops listening to this, you're not going to be able to find the CEO to fight for you. There's just not an option, or maybe you're not large enough for them to really care. And so you're going to have the strong numbers so that they speak for themselves, and any bank's going to want to do this deal.
Hunt's exactly right. And I hate to say this, and I'm almost embarrassed to say it, but across my various properties and businesses in the organization, I probably bank with 6 to 7 different institutions. And I'm not proud of that. And I've always tried to be loyal to one or two. But it tends to be that every time there's another acquisition opportunity, growth opportunity, I go to the banks that I'm banking with and something might be odd, or it's not the perfect fit. So then I'm moving on to the next one. And over time, it means that you're in bed with a lot of different banks. And I think one of the other issues that I'll bring up that is problematic for, you know, a group like Dustin's or myself is that at some point, a lot of MSOs transition beyond that traditional small business banker. And there's not a lot of bankers that service groups in the middle, because there's the commercial lending groups, but they're looking for organizations and businesses that are doing, you know, $25, $50 million. And a lot of the small business banking groups are looking at businesses and organizations that might do $1, $2, $3 million. Well, who's servicing the businesses and organizations that are making between, say, 5 and 25 million? That's a really challenging place to be. And particularly when we look at the products by the US SBA, the Small Business Administration, those are really tailored for small businesses, not for MSOs.
Now, I'm not sure if you guys have come here, and you probably won't want to publicly share this on here either, but what a lot of people don't realize is there's limits to SBA. I think right now the SBA 7(a) limit is $5 million. So you're going to get to a certain point if you're trying to scale this that the SBA is not going to give you any more money. We've given you all the money that we're going to give you and you have to prove yourself. Where when I see a lot of people scaling, they have to either find that bank that's willing to do this conventionally or willing to go along with them on a ride. But realistically, for most multi-shop operators that I see, they originally start the SBA route. They try to go commercial, but most of these guys are doing, you know, owner financing or some sort of alternative method because you're pushed kind of to the secondary or tertiary markets. And you're right, CJ. Like it's in one aspect, you're too big for the classic banker that's used to one location. But then when you go to the next level, you're way too small to even, you know, get a meeting with some of these guys. So kind of getting that creative financing to, you know, handle these deals is, you know, what a lot of people are trying to do and a lot of times struggling.
This banking discussion was very interesting and I think extremely critical in trying to learn to scale, but also in the struggles that many shop owners have in not being able to manage their cash, to consolidate, to pay off debt because they don't know how to talk to a banker. They only know how to talk to a car. And the cars don't talk back. And that's why they do this.
Right. And this is where I think the platforms like yours, Carm, just does a really extraordinary job of allowing a lot of operators that just know that car extraordinarily well, but need to understand how do we look at a P&L? How do we educate ourselves beyond fixing a car? How do we think about ourselves as a hospitality industry rather than just a, you know, fixing car industry? And I think there's a sophistication that you've been talking about for years that is so critical to us elevating this industry to one where, you know, we're more highly respected. We're a trade that people know require engineering sophistication. And everyone within our trade, whether it be the technicians, the front office staff, the owners, everyone needs to step up their game.
I so appreciate this. Saju Thomas, Hunt Demarest, Dustin Brown. An enlightening discussion. Hunt will make you the rap guy. We'll do Dustin first, Saju, and then Hunt. Dustin, final words or three?
Final words would be just be smart with your money. Cash is king.
That was a great final. Be smart with your money. Cash is king. I love it. Saju Thomas, talk to me, man.
Well, I'll keep it simple. Leverage is a tool. If you overuse it, you're going to be in dangerous waters. But if you use it smart, it's great for growth. It's great for scaling. And it's great for risk management.
And so many of the marginal or struggling shops, it says, now I got to learn something new, how to leverage. Wow. But you know what? It's critical. And again, this is where I would pick up the phone and say, Hunt, teach me how to leverage. Hunt, your final words.
Final words. I mean, I guess, you know, kind of coupling on what these guys have said on this is be smart. Know your own finances, know your own direction, know what you're trying to do here. And keep in mind, you might have got to this point and it might have taken you 4 or 5 years and maybe missed decisions, missed opportunities to build up this debt. Don't try to get out of it in the next 5 months because it's a recipe for disaster.
Well, thank you all so much. Tactics to stay out of debt. I learned a lot. Very enlightening. Thanks, guys.
Appreciate it, Carm.
Thanks, Carm.
Thanks for being on board to listen and learn from the premier automotive repair business podcast, Remarkable Results Radio. Get your episodic education on the ARPN listening app at automotiverepairpodcastnetwork.com. Also, enjoy the podcast on our Carm Capriotto YouTube channel. Carm is all for advancing the professional automotive service industry. Until next time.